Welcome to the Athenaeum Review podcast, where we talk about the ideas that shape our world. I'm Ben Lima, and our guest today is Itai Weinrib, who is Associate Professor of Art History at the Bard Graduate Center in New York. Among his many publications, he's author of the book The Bronze Object in the Middle Ages, and curator of Agents of Faith, Votive Objects in Time and Place, and editor of the accompanying catalog, both of which were named as Best of the Year by the New York Times. And he's received many prestigious fellowships, including the Center for Advanced Study in the Visual Arts in Washington, D.C., the Kunsthistorisches Institut in Florence, and the Institute for Advanced Study in Princeton. Thank you for being with us today.
Thank you for having me.
I wanted to start by asking about your current research on the Black Sea, a time, I think, around the 14th centuries when there were Byzantines, Genoese, Phoenicians, he said, Slavic peoples, Muslims. Could you just tell us a little bit about the kind of artistic culture of this time and place and the kinds of objects that were produced?
Yeah. The current project is titled Art and Frontier, and it basically questions what is the role and practice and function of art in what we might call frontier societies. Yeah. Frontier societies, you know, speaking in Texas, that was once a frontier. Frontier societies have, you know, a certain way to go about things and a certain manner in which the art they produce have significance to the local community. And what my project is trying to investigate is how basically colonial forces, that of the Genoese and the Venetians, in the mid-13th century all the way through the end of the 15th century, were producing art to convert and control indigenous communities, and on the other hand, producing luxurious objects that then will be exported back to the mainland, so to speak, to Genova and Venice. Within this network, one of the greatest products, or if we can call it a product, is of course slavery. And we're talking about almost 250,000 slaves that were exported from the Black Sea back to Venice and Genoa in a period of maybe 10 years. So the local forces, which are Western Mongolian tribes and local Tatars, were very much influenced by the presence of these early moments of colonial forces. And in a way, the project ties to investigate how early modes of colonialism and even globalism took place way before the 15th and 16th and 17th century, what we know as the era of European imperialism and colonialism.
And you mentioned before I asked you about this discussion of Robert Bartlett describing the kind of colonialism taking place really throughout Europe. But so this is outside, let's say, the center of Western Europe and so forth, but it's very nearby, and it sort of prefigures what's happening a little bit later.
Right. So it's in a way it's the expansion of Europe. Well, Robert Bartlett in his seminal study calls it, which is entitled The Making of the Middle Ages, talks about the constant expansion of what is known Europe, from a Europe that basically its east side is somewhere in the middle of modern day Germany, all the way to Europe that takes over Eurasia and even parts of the Black Sea. The Black Sea today has its western shores in Romania and Hungary and the Ukraine. And so it is very much, as we think about, as European territory. But in the mid-13th century, when the first missionaries were arriving to the Black Sea, this was not thought as a European place.
Yeah.
And so there's a process of conversion into Christianity, colonization, subjection of human beings, and then the exploitation as slaves, and the taking over of natural resources, especially metal mines, where copper and silver were excavated. And we know that the arrival of the West into that territory basically created a new balance of natural resources. What usually came from the Harz region in Germany or from Africa all of a sudden arrived from the Black Sea, which created a whole new economy, global economy, as much as we can say, around the late 14th, early 15th century.
This this question of slavery, is it in the kind of objects and texts, is it openly discussed in a very explicit way, or is it something that's sort of hidden and repressed a little bit?
That's a good question. There are ways to talk about slavery. On the one hand, we know of purchasing of slaves, and we have documents about that. But then the question is, what is the definition of slavery at that exact moment? And is it our modern perception? Another way of dealing with slavery is, of course, looking into the numbers, so to speak. So what kind of material is excavated in the mines in the Black Sea, and what kind of workforce, or how many people do you need to excavate this material? And then you can get more closely to the numbers of slaves that were forced to work in those mines. It is safe to say that most art at that period, whether architecture or small minor art, had a slavery component attached to all of that. Yeah. And there's new ways in which we have to think about how to approach that question, not just as a moral issue that is wrong, but how slavery was actually an engine for a lot of things, of things that were consumed in Europe, a lot of luxury objects that were consumed in Europe, and how basically slavery was viewed as part of the economy.
Yeah. In the terms of the kind of the economics of slavery, are there parallels to the kind of Mediterranean situation with the slave raids on the Mediterranean coast and things like that?
Absolutely. I mean, you know, the Black Sea is not so far from the Mediterranean. And we know of, you know, slave trades in North Africa leading all the way to Cairo and the Eastern Mediterranean, Jerusalem, modern-day Lebanon, and others where slavery was a common practice. We actually know of a certain trader mentioned in the Jewish Geniza by the name of Abraham Ibn Iju, who was a trader that was born in Tunisia, lived in Cairo, then moved to Aden, and eventually operated a bronze casting workshop in Bangalore in South India. And he had a slave. And that slave became the hero or the protagonist of a book by Amitav Ghosh called In Foreign Lands. Wow. So slavery was a common thing. The Jewish Geniza in Cairo, for instance, have many, many documents about the place and role of slavery within medieval Islamic societies.
Wow. I thinking about the geography and the way, I guess, the Genoese colonists and traders spread so far, I think many of us might have this idea that in terms of art and art history, that the kind of so-called central or metropolitan locations are the place where there is kind of the original creativity and the more privileged artworks, which eventually is sort of echoed in the provinces. But would you say that that the kind of culture that's happening here in the Black Sea is then actually things originate there, which then go back and have an impact in Genoa, that it's not just a one-way kind of influence?
Of course, it's what we call a crisscross area of exchange in which one is influenced by the other. One of the more interesting theories about these moments is actually by an historian who worked on the Great Lakes District in the area of Chicago in the moment of colonization, where he shows, he invents this term, the middle ground. And the middle ground is that place in which the forces meet, and he shows how each force or each community, whether it's the settlers or the indigenous population, assume the role that they think the other party would expect them to play. Yeah. And so there's a way in which even the subjected influence the forces that subject them. So even the local Tatars and Mongolians, of course, influence the behavior of the Genoese and Venetians colonists. Yeah. And that affects them all the way back to Venice and Genoa and to Italy.
This whole topic in an article that you recently published in Speculum on the bronze doors of Hildesheim in Germany, you describe kind of the frontier situation of the Ottonian Empire around the year 1000 and this really fascinating conflict between pagans and Christians, between Germans and Slavs, and really the kind of bloody battles that were fought between them, which sheds light on these doors and the bronze doors and bronze column as being a part of this frontier world. Would you say that I guess my question is, did this turn out differently kind of here on the frontier in comparison to, let's say, the more central locations to the empire like Aachen or Mainz? Like you see the results of this conflict right in the artifacts.
So the story of that essay, the Speculum essay, which is one of my recent prides and joys, because it took a long time to write this thing. For those of you who don't know, the bronze doors in Hildesheim are a masterpiece that is basically being taught in every textbook of art history around the world. Yeah. They count as the first monumental biblical narrative on the exterior of a church in the history of mankind. So it's the first time that there is the Christian story on the exterior of the church, and it is the first large-scale bronze casting historiated, that is to say, with a narrative that post-date the decline of the Roman Empire. Yeah. So it's a primordial object. It's a first of its kind object. It's a beginning of a whole tradition that later develops in other bronze doors and other monumental sculpture. For years, this work was investigated in light of being an echo of things that are happening in Rome, especially in ancient Rome. And it was thought that the commissioner of the doors, Bernhard of Hildesheim, was traveling to Rome and he saw these ancient monuments and decided to copy them and build them in Hildesheim. Now, I started investigating this question for a conference that was accompanying an exhibition at the Metropolitan Museum of Art on Hildesheim and its treasures. And it was a little bit of a moment like CSI Miami or something, in which you start reading the bibliography again. And I basically read 200 years of bibliography written on the bronze doors of Hildesheim. And you read it and it just doesn't make any sense. It doesn't make sense that a guy by the name of Bernhard will go to Rome, look at the wooden doors in Santa Sabina, which have some narrative on them, and then we'll go back home and create bronze doors that weigh 3 tons and are almost 5 meters high, that is to say almost 15 feet high, in bronze, which is much more a much harder thing to do. And at the same time, it didn't seem right that he will go and look at the Trajan Column in Rome, which is a 24-meter high column that has a staircase inside the column that you can actually climb all the way to the top, and create a bronze column in Hildesheim that is 270 centimeter height. So it all of a sudden doesn't make any sense. Also, you start reading about Hildesheim at the time of Bernhard, and this is a village basically with 400 people, no more.
Yeah.
And then you start asking yourself, why people in a village with 400 people will build or create bronze doors that weigh 3 tons and are so massive. Yeah. They are so massive that they can be seen from everywhere. It cannot be only for the love of God. There should be something else there. Yeah. And then I started reading about history and seeing where Hildesheim was situated politically at that period, and it was really on the edges of the Ottoman Empire, and it was part of a big campaign to convert the local Slav population. Basically, Hildesheim was a frontier society. That was the beginning of the project that later now becomes the Black Sea project. Hildesheim was a frontier society. This was the place where bishops left to go on campaigns to convert Slavs all over northern Germany and northeast Germany in places like Hamburg, Oldenburg, and as well as modern day Poland, like Jolin and other places. Modern-day Warsaw, etc., etc., etc. So then you start rereading the object in light of all of this, and you do a little bit of calculation as to how much copper do you need to make a 3 tons bronze doors, and you get to a calculation of about 2,700 kilograms of copper, and then you ask yourself how much rock has to be removed from the earth in order to get 27 kilograms of copper. And we know today that the average is that a rock will have 3% copper in it, which means that you have to have a lot of rock removed to the earth. And we know that there are nearby mines in Hildesheim, which means that the local population had to be the one that is mining, using those mines to excavate the material, excavate the copper. And so that's how I got to all of these questions of slavery, conversion, conversion in light of creating Christian works of art, which means you are enslaving pagan population, and this pagan population eventually manufactures an object that is part of their conversion process, because they are creating Christian idols as pagans, and that's in itself a very interesting case. So that was the Hildesheim story, and this is kind of like an idea or an attempt to revise the history of art and rethink the history of art. History of art is traditionally written as the history of masterpieces, and if you have a masterpiece in Hildesheim, it means that its origin should be another masterpiece in an earlier period. Right, that's right. How art history was written. And we are in a different stage in which art history looks more into the political, social, anthropological, economical contexts in order to understand better what kind of what are the origins of these questions, what are the origins of works of art such as these.
It's so interesting. One of the in the same article you discussed several examples of these pagan columns, these Jupiter columns, which I was amazed these have survived all the way to the present, and I guess there are a number of examples throughout. I guess I was surprised that these were never destroyed, or did Christians in throughout these centuries remember and recognize what these columns were, and kind of they were preserved and not, smashed in iconoclasm or something like that?
So that's a good question. I mean, the Jupiter columns as a Roman phenomenon that develops relatively late and only in German-speaking lands. I think there were many more Jupiter columns that we have surviving today. Yeah. I think today we have maybe 25, but there were hundreds before. But you're absolutely right. I think the people who converted in German lands into Christianity did not go through the same process of iconoclastic destruction of ancient temples and pagans and paganism. And it's kind of survived side by side with Christianity. We have the tendency to look at Christianity as one political entity that has one agenda. And this is not always right. The Christian agenda in, let's say, in Spain during the conversion is different than the one that you have in German-speaking lands at that same period. And some people, and I know you work on German art in the 20th century, some people see the Roman Germanic tradition as something that continued all the way to the rise of Hitler and Nazism. I mean, a lot of the symbols that the Nazi Party and nationalistic art is using in 20th century Germany originate from Roman ideals, and especially Roman German ideals. Yeah. And these are ideals that are found also in operas by Wagner and other, which are all about mythological figures in German sagas that historically lived in the Roman period side by side with Romans from, you know, from Italy. So those people, I think there is some kind of continuation from the Middle Ages onto modern day Germany, and that's maybe one of the reasons that these things were still celebrated. Yeah. I have a colleague who still works on, you know, Christian rituals in Germany that survive until today, and they deal with the worshipping of forests, actually, which is something that exists in Christianity in Germany until this very day, or at least until the early 20th century, in which people used to worship trees and forests on specific celebrations, especially around Easter. Yeah. Of course, with the reception of Christianity, this practice morphed into the celebration of the tree as the tree of life, or the tree on which Christ was crucified, but the origins are completely pagan. And we know other many pagan customs that morphed into Christianity, whether it is the Easter Bunny or basically Santa Claus and other examples.
Well, the Christmas tree would be.
Christmas tree. And a Christmas tree is, of course, a pagan. So there's a lot of things that continue that might explain why not everything was destroyed by Christianity. As well as some kind of an appreciation for antiquities, I think.
Yeah.
Roman gods were still appreciated by many, many Christians.
Yeah. Wow. You've mentioned a couple of times and written about the idea of the primordial object, or and also the concept of the primordial. In an article, you discussed the translation of Plato's Timaeus and the ideas of creation in Genesis and in John's gospel. I wonder if you could talk about this idea of the primordial, both maybe how it's significant in your research and how it was seen by these artists at the time.
That's a great question. So the primordial is something that we can deal with both ways, right? One is historiographically, that is to say, we as art historians tend to organize things according to chronologies. There's one, and there's object one, and then when you have object one, you can have object two and three and four and five. I always, when I teach my students, I always tell them, you know, when you start studying, imagine that somebody takes you to a huge warehouse, like an IKEA warehouse, and tells you, all right, these are all the objects, and you have to learn them, and you go shelf by shelf, aisle by aisle, and you study all the objects, and after a few years you think, oh, I'm done, I know everything. And then somebody opens another door and there's a similarly big warehouse with many, many more objects you've never seen in your life. So the more objects you know, the better scholar you become. You have a more better understanding of objects. But these objects are set within chronologies, and we tend to emphasize primordial moments or initial moments in the creation of something. Now, I'm very interested in the way in which people thought about the objects at the time, which means not just the art historical chronology that says this is object number one, but also the effect of something being new, what we like to call the shock of new. I think there was a book called The Shock of New back in the day by an Australian art historian.
Robert Hughes,
yeah. Right? And the shock of new is something that is kind of a modernistic trope about art trying to shock, right? And art trying to be new constantly, be new within a very close and very set discourse. But there's something else that is deals with the breaking away from traditions. And in medieval or historical arts before the 20th century, I would say, the primordial is found in your ability to break away from a tradition. That is to say, break away from a series, break away from a tradition of making and a tradition of showing. Now, this breakaway, this chasm, so to speak, affects not just the maker, but obviously affects the reception of the object, right? And yeah. The object is becoming very unique in the way it is received. So the artist is making something new, but at the same time, the response to that something new is very different than what we are accustomed to in, let's say, 20th century art, right?
Yeah.
The new is not necessarily celebrated. The new is becoming a unicorn. New is becoming something that people don't know how to deal with. It's all, in many cases, marginalized. And then you have a new set of effects and categories to think with about the object and about the questions at hand. Rudolf Berliner, who was a Jewish historian in Germany before the war, wrote a whole beautiful essay about the idea of innovation in medieval art. And in medieval art, we have, in most cases, the same iconography over and over and over and over again. And then the question is, how do you innovate? How do you innovate a crucifixion that has a very set category of how the Christ on the cross should be displayed? How can you make something new? And the new, I think, is a really a carnal human desire. There is a carnal human desire among artists to make something new and not just to repeat themselves. And so the question that Berliner deals with is exactly how to make something new, how new is actually breaking away from a tradition, breaking away from a series, and creating something unique and innovative.
Yeah. I wanted to ask you also about the, well, with the recent exhibition on votive objects and these kind of objects more generally, where a kind of object that seems to be present across a very wide variety of cultures, across Asia, Europe, the Americas, and so forth, where someone essentially perhaps makes an object as an offering, either in gratitude for being delivered from some illness or some trial or something like that, or having some problem that's been resolved. I that's probably not the best definition, but I just wondered if, are these kinds of objects really found everywhere, or are there certain places where people don't make them? It seems like such a fundamental thing that I'm curious about if they're ever missing, or if you don't find them.
That's a great question. So the exhibition Agents of Faith deals with the way in which people charge objects with sentiment. And charging object with sentiment is a very, very broad category in human behavior. We all charge objects with sentiment. We have feelings toward our iPhone, toward our car. We have memories attached to our laptop and all kind of crazy things like that. The exhibition tries to focus on one subset of material or subset of objects within this category of objects that are charged with sentiment, and that is the one known as votive offering or votive objects. And the exhibition shows that making a votive is a global category. It is one of the earliest cultural practices in the history of mankind. Basically, could be paralleled with eating and drinking and sleeping. Making a votive is something that was always there. Yeah. We have votives as early as 5000 BC. And as I always say, as we speak in this room right now, somebody somewhere in the world is making a votive.
Yeah.
The exhibition doesn't try to claim that all votives are the same.
Yeah.
But what we say, or what we said when the exhibition was on, that human beings around the world throughout time, histories and geographies shared similar ideas, needs, hopes, desires and anxieties. And they channel these hopes, dreams, desires and anxieties through objects. And that was the way in which they related to the material and created the material. So in different cultures, Islamic, African, Christian, Jewish, and Buddhism and Hindu, different people have different needs, but and they produce different objects, but they basically produce them from identical or similar human needs and human desires and hopes and dreams. So we are not trying to say that everything is the same, but we're saying that the catalyst or the engine for making these objects is similar around the world and throughout time. Yeah. And what we did in the exhibition is to try to exemplify how this worked, or what kind of categories were major or prevalent in the making of these objects.
Yeah. One thing that struck my interest, I guess that there's, especially in the Catholic areas in southern Germany and Bavaria and Austria, there are churches with very large collections of these objects. And I wondered, well, is kind of what happened in the Protestant areas? Did that sort of die out, or it was pushed out of the churches maybe, or it took another form? Mm-hmm. I don't know if that was covered in.
So the exhibition benefited greatly from a collection that is now in the Bayerische Nationalmuseum in Munich, where an ethnologist / curator in the early 20th century by the name of Rudolf Kreis started traveling in Bavaria, in the Tyrol, in modern day Austria, and as well as in Italy and Sardinia, and collected, purchased votives in various churches, and amassed a huge collection of, I think, 40,000 objects that make the Department for Folklore, for Volkskunde, in the Bayerische Nationalmuseum. And it's all originally his collection, and he tried to basically identify all kind of traditions around Catholicism. In the north, where the majority of the community is Protestant, we have different customs. It's more about candles, lighting candles.
Right, right.
It's less about making offerings as objects.
Yeah.
There's a lot about donations.
Yeah.
There's a lot about giving money to the community. But objects, specific objects, I don't know that they indeed existed.
Yeah.
Well, I know that in places in northern Germany, especially in seaside churches, a lot of people offer votive ships to the church as a kind of a guaranteeing or for the safekeeping of the ship in the actual ship in the ocean.
Yeah.
But yeah, Protestants, in Protestant culture, is mainly candles in all kind of shapes and forms.
Yeah.
That is the major votive thing that is given.
It also, learning about this a little bit, also made me think about secularization or this idea of secularization, where maybe, let's say, in the Middle Ages, the authorities, the elite, the bishop could say, well, we this is the care of your soul is important. We're doing this for your soul, and the kind of elite discourse was concerned with faith and religion, metaphysics, and so forth. But if you look at what's happening now, one of the interesting phenomena I thought was the way that at the Vietnam Memorial, which you discussed in your presentation, every single day votive objects are left in memory of the soldiers. So at a popular level, there are many, you know, countless votive objects being made and offered every day, as you say. But yet, in terms of the elite, you know, you wouldn't have, like, the president of the United States saying, I'm going to make an offering so we have a good harvest this year, or, you know, in academia, you wouldn't say, well, I made an offering so my experiment succeeded or my book got a good review, and so forth. So I just wonder what happens, you know, when the kind of elite is secularized, this need, this fundamental human need, do you think it just have to be satisfied in some other way other than making an offering, or do people still sort of do it secretly? Or I'm just curious if it's only a popular phenomenon at this point, or if there's some manifestation elsewhere.
Where exactly?
Well, you know, it seems, correct me if I'm wrong, that part of the, like, let's say in this country, in the United States, that it's a very robust, like at the Vietnam Memorial,
mm-hmm.
there's a lot of these votive offerings. But I think if you talk to, you know, other academics or professors or scientists or so forth, they might say, well, this is interesting anthropologically, but you know, I wouldn't do this myself, or it's not, it may be a sort of a primitive custom that people do, but if we really want to understand the world scientifically, it's not.
Well, you know, our argument in the exhibition, that is it's a human need, and you can't really overcome that human need. And every time I gave a tour in the exhibition, I said, you know, you don't have to tell me, but I'm sure all of you took a rock and buried it next to a tree at a certain point. Made something and gave it away, engraved your name in a place you shouldn't engrave your name in. The Vietnam Memorial phenomenon is the beginning of a whole tradition, a tradition that is basically, I like to call, votive giving within a secular context. Now, the person who wrote the essay for the catalog, David Morgan, who is a professor for religious studies in Duke University, deals in his essay exactly with the reasons why it developed. So we can talk about the nation state as a new religion, and we can talk about things like Michael Jackson or David Bowie or Lady Diana as a new formulation of a modern saint, right? These people have importance that is beyond the human being, beyond the human existence, right? They become larger than life, so to speak. And people try to associate all kind of things to them because they are larger than life. We all at least met once in their life somebody who Michael Jackson or some other star touched a piece of their clothing and they didn't wash that piece of clothing ever since. This is really basically traditions that develop in Christian cult of saints and are morphing into modernity. And to your to the answer of the critics, you know, again, this is a human desire. I was around when Steve Jobs died, and I remember walking in Manhattan next to all the Apple stores, and every Apple store had a little shrine outside with pictures and coffee mugs and candles and symbols of Apple and Macintosh and whatnot, which people came and brought to the store and placed it by themselves. Nobody from the Apple Corporation was organizing or orchestrating this practice. People do that on their own velocity. This is true for sites of national trauma like 9/11 or Oklahoma bombing, or in Europe where there are sport-related catastrophes. We always find something. Recently, the Thai owner of a certain football team in England crashed with his helicopter. You remember that was two months ago. And within hours, there was a shrine in honor of this deceased owner of the football team, in which people didn't just bring flowers, they also bought photographs, articles of clothing, and even somebody brought a model of a helicopter to symbolize the helicopter crash itself. So again, this is a human endeavor. I think in modernity, there's always a desire among us, the disassociated, dissolute human beings that don't feel belonging to anywhere, to come together as a community. And these sites of commemoration and mourning are always a way for people to feel belonging to a greater community. By meeting people at the shrine, by participating in a ritual, you become part of a community. And I think in modern day culture, especially in big cities, whether it is Dallas or New York, you really have this desire to become a member of a community. And a community is something that we are all losing once we stop going to the church or to the synagogue every week, right? And many people don't go to the church or to the synagogue or to the mosque every week. And they're looking for other ways to feel belonging to somewhere else, to somewhere. And that's a way to answer those people.
Yeah, that certainly makes a lot of sense. I'm not sure if this was discussed in the exhibition or addressed, but I was also curious within the world of, let's say, of contemporary art, and a certain artists like Thomas Hirschhorn, who kind of orchestrate or set up these situations with these altars. I've thought, well, it's really interesting what he's doing to kind of create these these altars or shrines, I forget the terminology, to different cultural figures. But my reaction is also somehow a little bit suspicious because, you know, I guess part of the power of what you've just described, the sheer spontaneity and anonymity, you know, people, hundreds or thousands of people kind of appearing from nowhere to leave flowers for Princess Diana or so forth, that somehow seems authentic because it's unplanned, it's popular, it's spontaneous, whereas I somehow feel a little bit more suspicious when an artist says, okay, I'm going to plan this in advance, I'm going to create it. I wonder whether he's somehow less real or less authentic than that. But that might be a problematic way of talking about it. I don't know if you...
Well, I think in contemporary art today, especially since Umberto Eco published the Opera Aperta, or the open work, I think it was in the 50s or 60s, there is the idea... we find the idea of what we call participation, that is to say, the need or the desire on behalf of the artist to create works of art in which there is a participatory angle to them, that is to say, in which the visitor, the looker, is becoming an active participant in the work of art, and through their participation, the work of art is constantly being interpreted and reinterpreted and even remodeled. This is a practice that is common, I think, from the 30s. You have it especially, and I think Umberto Eco talks about composers, right? How the audience in a musical set is in a way an interpreter or participator in the actual work of art. And today we have many artists, whether it's Yoko Ono, there's some Brazilian artist, Neuschwander, who creates another work in which people have to participate, and other people who create shrines and works of art in open spaces. Even Richard Serra, if you think about it, his massive sculpture needs a participant, right? It's not... Richard Serra's huge sculpture is not something you can just look at. You have to walk through. And by walking through, you create something new. The work of art is becoming something else. Yeah. So I think most or many of the artists today need or think of the viewer slash participator as an active partner in their work of art. Yeah. And they can direct them up to a certain point. But the open art is always open in a way. The work of art is always open. It's an open work. And it enables you to be part of this world of the world of contemporary art.
That reminds me, I have to mention, I don't know if you'll see it today in Fort Worth, but at the Modern Art Museum of Fort Worth, there's a Richard Serra which you approach as you enter the museum, and I would say almost everyone who comes to that museum, kind of, you can walk inside, they spontaneously go in, and you can start kind of kicking the sculpture, and it resonates, and it sounds like an enormous bell, and it's you know, everyone enjoys it, and it's, you know, there's no instructions or kind of directions to do this, but it's the reaction that seemingly every visitor has. So I think that's an excellent example. I wanted maybe just ask one or two questions about your book on bronze, this very powerful material that had so many uses in medieval art, and you written about doors and fountains and bells. I don't know if you would agree with this, but my interest was that I guess you show how whether or not an object is conceived of as art in the, you know, the modern museum sense of art, that there's this enormous range of kind of powerful effects, whether it's the sound of the bells or the kind of weight and physical force of the massive doors and things like that. Would you say, I mean, just to be kind of provocative, would you say, well, we don't even need the category of art because there's so many ways that these objects have power, we don't need to divide it at all into art and not art? Or is that misunderstanding?
That's a good question. I mean, my book on the bronze object in the Middle Ages didn't really deal with questions of art, non-art, right, because it took its cue from focusing on the technique of making, and that book focused specifically on lost wax casting as a technique of making. And when you focus on the technique of making, you initially go to the place where the things were made, that is to say the workshop, the casting workshop, the foundry where these things are made. And you find that as much as there are works of art, let's say high-end sculpture that is being cast in these places, at the same time, the same people cast bells and fountainheads and all kind of things that are more utilitarian. And then you get to a category of objects that is art and non-art, that is very broad and expanded field of what can be defined as art. What I did show in the book that also bells and fountainheads were regarded as works of art. A fountainhead was a source for water, that is to say, a source for life for a medieval community. I focus on the fountain in Perugia as a one example for a fountain that was erected by the city, and we have well-known artists both sculpting the fountain and casting the bronze part of the fountain. So it was very much something that was done by artists, but at the same time it was a utilitarian object. We know the church bells as well were cast and designed by high-end artists, but they were utilitarian objects. So the category of art, no art, doesn't really exist at that period in that way, especially if you focus on the material and the technique, you get into something broader. Also the effect that that a fountain has, or that a bell has, or the bronze sculpture has, are kind of identical, and in Latin writing we call them marvel, right? Mirabilia. They are all regarded as mirabilia because the effect on the viewer is similar, this shock of awe. It's like, wow, right? You say wow when you hear the bell, you say wow when you look at the fountain, and you say wow when you see the bronze sculpture. So people at that time, writers at that period in the Middle Ages, were not really good in conveying the differences between the shock or the astonished look when you look at a good sculpture or a beautiful sculpture to that when you look at a marvelous fountain, for instance.
That's amazing. Well, our guest today is Itai Weinrib, who is curator of the exhibition Agents of Faith, Votive Objects in Time and Place, and editor of the accompanying catalog, which is a beautiful object in itself. Thanks for coming into the podcast.
Thank you for having me.
This is the Athenaeum Review podcast, where we talk about the ideas that shape our world, produced by Creative Disturbance. Find out more at creativedisturbance.org.